Hello and welcome to House to Astonish episode 66. I'm Paul O'Brien.
And I'm Al Kennedy. And in a week when riots and flames engulf the whole of England, we ask, are these Fear Itself tie-ins going a bit far?
Whatever happened to the good old days where people rioted about sensible things like Millwall? Coming up later, we will be looking at Mystic, Severed, and the Cloak and Dagger series, Spider Island. But first, news.
Yes, news. The big bit of news, really, of course, is the Ultimate Spider-Man thing, where, ironically, as so often happens with our podcast, we record and then literally the next day they announce some big bit of news. So we're a little behind the wheel on this one.
News from 2 weeks ago.
Yes, but, Miles Morales is your new Ultimate Spider-Man, half black, half Latino, a character that was a bit of a swerve because I think a lot of people were expecting it to be Ultimate Ben Reilly.
Yes, they were clearly set, by all accounts, they were setting that up, and there was a bit of fainting in that direction, which is actually quite good because, you know, they've done something which was not entirely predictable, but is still, you know, fairly predictable.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I really thought when the news came out, oh, this is Miles Morales, and Ultimate Fallout 4 got leaked, or, you know, got told to the press, basically, the day before it came out. It's like, wow, they actually managed to do a swerve on us. We were all like, oh, well, they're obviously going to go for a black Spider-Man. It's obviously going to be Ben Reilly. Oh, can we ever get away from this cycle of Peter Parker and Ben Reilly swapping backwards and forwards to Spider-Man? And then it's this guy that we've never heard of. It's like, oh, well, that was a surprise. Good.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. This has done pretty well for them. The Death of Spider-Man issue itself topped the sales chart in June by quite a margin. Ultimate Fallout 1 is a bit further down the charts in July, but with the amount of publicity they got for this, I'm sure that they will do very well with Ultimate Fallout 4 when that comes out.
I'm sure we'll see multiple printings of Fallout 4.
And Ultimate Spider-Man 1. And they've managed, I think, to get across in the media the idea that people are actually interested in the other Spider-Man being killed, which is a tricky sell.
It has been interesting to see the coverage of it because so many people have been reporting it as Marvel are killing Spider-Man and replacing him with, and then depending on what paper you read, an ethnically diverse version or a politically correct version.
He's probably going to turn out to be homosexual as well.
Yeah, I saw that in the Daily Mail. It was an Ultimate Spider-Man replaced with mixed-race Spider-Man who might even be gay. It's like, oh, wow, he's just got all the boxes ticked for you, hasn't he, Daily Mail? You can really work yourself up into a frothing lather over this.
Well, I mean, the Daily Mail can work itself up into a frothing lather over virtually anything, to be fair. It was one of the admirable things about the Daily Mail. They really are indiscriminate in their anger.
If nothing else, they're certainly passionate. They have these Wolverine-style berserker rages that never seem to stop. It must be very tiring to work for the Daily Mail.
I genuinely imagine the Daily Mail newsroom consisting entirely of people picking up things off the wire and going, ah!
Yeah, exactly. Just grabbing their computers and screaming into them.
And I think that nobody actually speaks words in the Daily Mail office. They just scream at one another in suppressed rage.
Someone knocks the door of the editor's office and the editor's like, "Mah!" And then they open the door and go, "Mah!" And you're like, "Mah!" And they just yell at each other like some kind of deranged Weeble and Bob.
Spider-Man, though.
Yeah, oh, back to Spider-Man.
There is an issue generally with Marvel and DC in terms of needing more diversity in their characters. To some extent, it is a historical phenomenon based on all of their characters are, or their most successful characters were created in the 60s.
Yeah.
A few in the 70s, and relatively few from the 80s or 90s have stuck. And the ones that back in the 60s and indeed the 40s, when many of the top characters were being created, standards were unfortunately a bit different. Now, many of these characters don't really have to be white. Many of them would actually be in some ways better off in modern day, given a different background. The Ultimate Universe has done this before with Nick Fury.
Yes, almost straight off the bat. I mean, Nick Fury's first two appearances, he was a white guy, but after that, he was a black guy from then on.
I think, strictly speaking, in his first couple of appearances, he's just standing in very heavy shadow, and you can't actually tell what
he's doing. The first time he appears is at the end of the Mike Allred-drawn two-parter in Ultimate Marvel Team-Up.
Yes.
Where, in the last panel, he leans forward out of the shadow, and he is basically ordinary Nick Fury, old Nick Fury.
Really?
And then the second time he appears, he's been recoloured for the collections, but when he was originally drawn by Tom Rainey in his floaty shoes, that whole front, that big splash page of him in a suit descending from on high with his floaty shoe technology. He was basically a white guy. And he's been darkened a bit for the collections.
Well, anyhow, if this sticks, then it's probably a good thing for Marvel just as a matter of principle. It also gives Ultimate Spider-Man a reason to exist, aside from just being a younger version of Spider-Man, given that they don't want the actual Spider-Man to be that old to start with.
Yes, absolutely. And it's the kind of thing where people are saying, oh, it's a marketing ploy. They're saying it's a cynical marketing thing. It's not story-driven.
That's the question. Is it a cynical marketing ploy?
Yes. Or is it one of these wholesome marketing ploys that we all know about from Disney movies?
Yeah. I mean, of course it's intended to sell comics. But the Ultimate imprint's been flagging for a few years. We've already had one horrifically botched relaunch. They really did need to do something drastic to persuade people that this was a line that people should be paying attention to again. Now, I think there was definitely a significant chance that this could backfire horribly on them, but I think it's worked pretty well, actually. I think that this has done a reasonable job of persuading people that the Ultimate imprint matters, and that the Ultimate imprint is something which, if you're following comics, you should be paying attention to.
Yes, well,
it's going to have really helped the upcoming relaunches of things like Ultimate X-Men. I think there will be a spillover that will benefit those books.
It will, but I think it only will do so to people who are already comics fans. What this will
But they've already lost a lot of them. Well, getting those back is good for the survival of the line.
What it'll do, you're absolutely right, but what it will do in the short term is it will have people walking in off the streets saying, I want this comic that's got the Black Spider-Man in it. And the retailers will be able to give them a copy of Ultimate Fallout 4 if they ordered enough copies, and I presume that there will be multiple printings of it to allow them to do this. But then,
what
3 months from
sell?
Now or 2 months from now, are these people going to come back? And yes, you're absolutely right, what else do they sell them? But 2 months from now, are people going to come back and buy Ultimate Spider-Man issue 1? Are they going to remember? I'm really not sure that they will.
Most of them obviously won't, but you don't expect to convert most of your new sales into permanent sales. That's just not the way it works. If a few of them pay a bit more attention to comics in general, you never know. You might, and some of them will be buying digitally as well. I suppose in the short term, the question is, what do you sell them to go with their copy of Ultimate Fallout 4? Is Ultimate Fallout numbers 1, 2, and 3, and the Death of Spider-Man collection.
Yeah, well, which isn't out yet, but the interesting thing, well, I say the interesting thing, I've said that about 6 times now, the annoying thing about, you say you may buy things digitally. I had a look on Marvel's digital app, and on the day that the whole Miles Morales thing came out in the news, when people are going to be looking to the Death of Spider-Man storyline, how much, if you wanted to really shift that online, how much would you have priced that at? Would you have had a one-day 99-cent sale, as Marvel do twice a week, and put those books in one day 99 cents on the day that it's in USA Today? Because that's what I would have done. Unfortunately, they were full price, £2.49 an issue for 6 issues, which gives you something which will be more expensive than the collection.
I understand where they're coming from, though, in the sense of, I mean, are you talking about the Death of Spider-Man issues? Oh, yeah, those they should have discounted. Mm. Absolutely, those they should have discounted. Ultimate Fallout 4 itself, they can't discount, because then they'd be undercutting the retailers who've already placed orders in good
faith. Yeah, that's fine. I completely understand that. But it's a complete lack of synergy between the digital side of things and the print side of things, which is weird, because they usually have at least some kind of crossover. When they do these 99-cent sales, they'd like to be able to tie them into something that's happening.
I think that's a really good point, actually. It's something they should do more of with digital. So, here's a book we want you to jump on board with. For the next few days, we're slashing the price on the last 6 issues.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's like Spider Island launched, for instance, last week. What they should have had was the last few issues of Spider-Man leading up to Spider Island. They should have been one-day sale, 99 cents each. That primes you, it gets you absolutely up to speed for Spider Island, which you can then go out and buy for $4.
Well, the last few issues of Amazing Spider-Man, to be fair, are mostly setting up a different story, but the backup strips that lead directly into Spider Island, they should have done a collection of those and heavily discounted it. I think that would have made sense. It's not going to cost them any sales. They've already had the first week sales on those books.
Yeah. And the other big effect that the Miles Morales thing has had is to allow us to identify racists on the internet, because there have been some unbelievable comments being posted on blogs, on news stories, and the USA Today story had some ferocious racism on it. And even things like Heidi had to delete a bunch of comments off a story on The Beat about Miles Morales because they were so incredibly racist. And eventually Heidi had to actually close the thread. It's just ridiculous. We like to think that, you know, oh, we're quite enlightened with our art of the 20th century. You know, we've given birth to this art form in the last 100 years, and aren't we forward thinking? And then, no, actually, you get reminded that there's nothing quite so conservative as a comics fan. And it seems to go beyond conservative into, for some very, very small minority, I've no doubt, number of people, into just pure racism. It's crazy. They had the same reaction later on that week when Lawrence Fishburne got announced as Perry White in the Superman movie. Like, to be fair to Lawrence Fishburne, he's a brilliant actor.
Yeah.
And he's going to be, you know, quite the best Perry. I mean, who are you going to compare him against? Lane Smith, for goodness sake. Michael McKean.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there are some fans who just have the mentality that they want everything to be exactly like it always was, and they want the movies to be as exactly like the comics as they can be. And some of these people would probably be equally upset if they'd cast an actor of the wrong age range or something like that. But, yeah, there are some who seem to have a very odd reaction to this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you're annoyed because Spider-Man from now on is not going to be Peter Parker, and it didn't matter who they put in the suit. If they put Harry Osborn in the suit, you would have been just as annoyed. That's, you know, that's understandable. If it's a character you like, then, you know, no one can fault you for getting a little bit annoyed that this character is being, you know, done away with in one iteration. And certainly he's still going to keep going in his regular Marvel appearances.
And there's certainly a case to be made that of all the characters of the A-list in superheroes, Spider-Man is possibly the least suited to have a legacy hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because his circumstances are so particular to him.
Yeah, exactly.
But if people are saying, I think Spider-Man shouldn't be a black guy, then, yeah, that's kind of racist. You know, if that's the reason why you think they shouldn't be replacing Spider-Man, because it shouldn't be a black guy, but you would have been happy if it was Harry or whoever, then, yeah, there's a problem there that needs to be looked at.
Well, that's the internet for you.
Yes, I've met the internet. In terms of movie stuff, apart from Lawrence Fishburne as Perry White, there have been a couple of pictures that have come out from DC's movies. Catwoman, we've seen a picture of Anne Hathaway modelling a Nintendo Virtual Boy as she seemingly rides the Batpod from the last movie. And Zack Snyder's Superman, first picture of him looking like a hair gel model.
Well, Superman never looks good in still photos.
Yeah, I mean, the costume that they've got him in is that horrible thing that they've been doing with some superhero characters recently, where it looks really thick and rubbery and fish scaly.
Oh, okay, that sort of... Yeah,
he looks like a vinyl action figure.
Well, he's Superman.
Yeah, he shouldn't look like a vinyl action figure unless he is the actual vinyl action figure, at least to tie in with the movie. That's okay.
I mean, it is a difficult one for costume designers. What do you make the material of? Because you just make it a stretchy fabric. They look like downhill skiers. And that's not really what you're going for with Superman. It's fine for downhill skiers.
Yes.
But, you know, it's not quite right for Superman. And it can't be proper clothes because then it won't be tight-fitting. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I see why they end up going for these slightly odd-looking materials that are neither one thing nor the other.
I think that the this rubbery-looking stuff that they've got him in looks pretty unpleasant, though. I don't know. It looks very Zack Snyder, really. It looks like the kind of thing, if you were to have guessed how would Zack Snyder dress Superman, then it would pretty much be exactly like this kind of squeezy dog toy that they've turned him into.
It does look like something that would be a bit impractical to wear under your suit.
Oh, man, you would drown in sweat. You would probably die of dehydration.
Why has no Superman story properly addressed the difficulties of having to wear that costume underneath a full suit in a hot summer?
With a cape and everything.
I suppose, to be fair, being an alien, maybe he's got better temperature regulation. Maybe that's one of his lesser-known superpowers.
He's got a very nice suit, lots of vents and stuff cut in the suit. It's one of these things, though, where it's a real kind of suspension of disbelief thing where you have to think, well, surely Matt Murdock is uncomfortable with that horned hood tucked down underneath his collar or whatever. Or, you know, Spider-Man having to run along hopping while he changes his booties. It's just the sort of thing where you have to hand wave it away or else you would never get on with telling the story.
Fantastic Four. It's coming back. The Human Torch, it seems, probably isn't dead after all.
Yeah, clearly it's not dead.
No, quite.
Look at the stories. Like, not even slightly any indication that he's dead.
I don't think they were even seriously trying to persuade anyone he was dead. It's just one of these, you take the character out of the, out of circulation for a couple of years and do the book with a different dynamic and then bring him back kind of thing. It's been done plenty of times before. It's a time-honoured story and, you know, I don't
particularly
really...
in the Fantastic Four.
Has that been done with Mr. Fantastic? It's been done with The
Thing.
Yeah. Has it been done with Sue?
Sue died in a one-shot, but it was... Johnny comes back and changes the timeline so that it doesn't happen in the real Marvel Universe, but he obviously goes back to his own time where it still did happen. It's playing with the Grunwald rules of time travel, which don't really seem to apply in the Marvel Universe anymore.
They also did a... There's also a lengthy period where she's on the sidelines because she's pregnant, but she was still in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, every member of the Fantastic Four has now been out for some period. And then fine. It's a book that's been going for 50 years. At some point, you've got to just say, well, okay, well, there are only so many stories you can do in this format. I don't have a problem with it. I have more of an issue with trying to hype it to the public, the casual fan, as the vitally important death of the Human Torch. But
yeah, I'd laugh if, you know, November rolled round and all that happened was Jim Hammond pitches up at the door of... the Baxter Building is like, there was an advert in the paper, vacancy for an on-fire bloke.
Actually, that's a point. It could be, couldn't it?
Could be Hammond, could be Toro is now back as well. They don't have the history of it. They wouldn't just shop in, we need a Human Torch. They get Captain Kerosene in. That's not going to happen. Someone on Twitter, I can't remember who it was today, suggested that possibly they're just going to set Spider-Man on fire. Which would be fantastic. FF is continuing alongside Fantastic Four. Fantastic Four is returning at issue 600. FF is still going on at issue 12.
So it's the same numbering deal they did with the Hulk.
Yes, the same maths that doesn't really work. Because either there are, you know, 11 issues which are issues of FF and therefore don't count towards the 600 issues of Fantastic Four, or FF is being renamed and renumbered to Fantastic Four, and they're launching a new book called FF starting at issue 12.
Well, I mean, the deal with Hulk was that those first 12 issues or so of Hulk were deemed to count towards the numbering of both series. Now, that doesn't make any sense.
No, none of this makes any sense.
But if it's sense you want, you're possibly in the wrong hobby.
Yeah, absolutely.
Marvel spit in the face of mathematics.
DC, on the other hand, are giving us a bit more information of the plans for stuff outside of the New 52. Mm. One of the things that's come out over the last few days is that Astro City is going to be returning as a monthly ongoing series.
Now that's something I'm very much looking forward to. Mm. I loved Astro City when that started. I wasn't quite
so
sure.
Did you
find
the Dark Age a bit of a slog?
I did find the Dark Age a bit of a slog. I've heard it reads better if you read it all in one sitting.
I think it's because it took so long for it to come out, and it's such a long story.
Yes, it maybe will work better in the collection. But a collection. Hopefully they'll do a collection of the back catalogue as well now that it's all going to be
reissue,
brought to...
Yeah, reissue all those old trades.
Do an omnibus.
That would be... I would love that.
I'd pick up an Astro City omnibus.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I got some comments about after I said that the DC New 52 omnibus was going to be the least satisfying thing that you could possibly read because it was, you know...
Heavy
and cumbersome and expensive and so on. And people say, well, that's the same with any omnibus. It's, well, yes. But the difference between the DC New 52 omnibus and, say, the Walt Simonson Thor omnibus is that the Walt Simonson Thor omnibus is one big, long, complete saga.
Yeah.
Which really gets you over the hump of the fact that it's an incredibly heavy book that's quite difficult to handle and costs a lot of money. You're getting a thoroughly satisfying reading experience for that, which is the same as you would get with Astro City. Whereas,
same deal with the... I think there's an Ecstatics omnibus coming out fairly soon.
Yes, absolutely.
That's a good idea as well.
Whereas something like the DC New 52 omnibus, where it's 52 chapter ones of things. Very bitty.
Oh, I don't
like the sound of that.
So yeah, an Astro City ongoing, as long as they can keep it on schedule, and they've certainly had a lot of lead-in time for it. Mm. I think will be great.
Do you know if Brent Anderson's coming back for it?
Well, I would assume so. He's done virtually all of Astro City.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of one-shots where it may have been somebody else, but yeah. I don't remember exactly. Another thing that Bob Wayne had announced over the last week or so was that they have been seeing far better sales digitally for comics such as World of Warcraft and Fringe than they were seeing in print.
So the licensed titles for DC apparently do better in digital than in print.
And so they may be moving them just entirely to print and not even doing... moving them entirely to digital and not even doing print versions.
Which is interesting because, according to DC, most of their books, their regular DCU and even their Vertigo titles, mm-hmm. do significantly better in print than they do in digital, where frankly they're not doing that much business at all. Mm-hmm. That suggests that these books are attracting a very different audience outside the direct market altogether, which I suppose shouldn't surprise us. That's the whole point of licensing, mm-hmm. something that appeals to a broader audience.
Yeah.
It's interesting in a way that that audience is prepared to hunt them out on the DC app. Are there other platforms where you can get these digitally?
I don't know. I've never watched Fringe. I've never played World of Warcraft. And so neither of the milieu actually appeal to me. I don't read the comics. It doesn't surprise me too much that people who play World of Warcraft are happy to seek out comics digitally. And, you know, if they're actually going to buy them at all, then that's brilliant. You're rather than what Absolutely. I would imagine many of them would do, which would be just to torrent them.
Yeah, and I can see sci-fi shows having enough hardcore fans that they will go out and buy the tie-in comics as long as they're, especially if they're given some sort of significance, if they're given some sort of official status. I can see that. It's interesting that that sort of audience is not going to the comic shop, it's going to the digital sales.
Yeah, it may well be that, you know, World of Warcraft players are, they're worldwide, you know, it's a huge international thing.
Well, that's a good point.
And, you know, are there outlets to buy, you know, Wildstorm World of Warcraft comics in, I don't know, Malaysia or wherever?
You may be right about that, but that it could simply be the international side of it. But I mean, it's a worrying sign in many ways for the comic shops that there's obviously an audience for these books, yet they aren't going into the comic stores.
Yeah.
And there's obviously a big enough audience digitally that they can afford to chuck away that, you know, 4,000 or so copies a month that they're doing in print.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't the comic stores getting these people in? Even, you know, if you're in New York and you're running a comic studio, why are they getting people in the door for this to buy these books?
Well, I
maybe
guess
is it a case where if you're only interested in buying one comic, you're not going to track down to a comic store,
and also
just to buy one thing.
Yeah, these are people who want to read about World of Warcraft. They're not people who want to read comics. They're not going in and saying, I want to buy this World of Warcraft issue. If they do that, then the question for the retailer of what else do you sell them doesn't arise, because they don't want anything else. They don't come in looking for a comics experience.
No.
They're not, you know, if you were to, you know, show them an issue of Severed or Mystic or Cloak and Dagger and say, well, if you enjoyed that book, well, maybe there's something that you liked about it that you might like in one of these comics. No, they just are interested in buying World of Warcraft, because that's what they're into.
Well, sure, but theoretically, the idea is that you get them into the habit of buying one title regularly,
mm-hmm.
and then once they've bought their, say, fifth or sixth issue of World of Warcraft, the ongoing title, then at some point, whether they're doing it online or in a store, they might look at something else and go, do you know, I quite enjoy reading a comic. Maybe I might quite enjoy reading another comic as well.
See,
now, that doesn't seem to be happening.
I don't think that it would happen. I think it's very much the, you know, man walks into a bar and asks for a copy of In Shadow of No Towers, you know. It's very much, he's not
interested. It's been a long time since anyone's mentioned that article to me.
Yeah, they're not interested. It's not a case of they don't like them. They don't care about them. They don't feel any negativity towards other comics. They want to read World of Warcraft because they like World of Warcraft. They're not into comics. Which is like saying you're not into films or whatever, but, you know, there are people who only like to go and see rom-coms at the cinema. There are people who only like to go and see action-y explosion movies and would never think of watching anything else. they're interested in this one thing.
I wonder if part of the issue that comics have is that in all genres, they're essentially aimed at fans.
Mm.
Fans of the characters, fans of the art form, fans even of his genre. You don't get that many comics that are aimed at a purely casual audience, unless it's things like the All Ages books that...
even then you're trading on a character recognition. You know, if you're trying to sell them an All Ages Spider-Man book, what you're trying to sell them first and foremost is a comic with the word Spider-Man on the front cover, because that's your IP. Yeah, that's branding, where the value lies in it.
But you're not necessarily trying to sell that to Spider-Man fans. You're trying to sell that to casual people, mm-hmm. casual buyers who've heard of Spider-Man, and there's a difference.
Yeah, if you're trying to sell it to Spider-Man fans and looking at the comparative sales figures of Marvel Adventures Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man, then something's going wrong at some point along the line anyway. That's the news from the last couple of weeks, and we're going to go on and talk about a few comic books now.
What should we start with? Severed?
Sure.
Severed. This is by Scott Snyder, Scott Tuft, and Attila Futaki.
Yes. Snyder and Tuft, co-writers, and Futaki on art and cover and colours, etc. as well. It's actually good that you've got such a small number of creators working on this one title, because it can really give you a very cohesive product when you've got so few people working on it together. This book is essentially, it's a 1920s it's set in?
It's 1916.
Yes, 1916.
When there's a framing sequence set in the 50s.
In the future there. It's like, well, it's the future of that, but it's our past. And, yeah.
It's the mid-50s is the framing sequence, and then the bulk of the story is a flashback to 1916.
Mm. Where there's a wee boy a guy called Jack, who, you know, living at home, seems to be getting on fine. His mum loves him, he's good at the violin, and he's all just going to go off to school. But then he decides he's going to run away from home and stow away on the trains and hang out with hobos. But
one of who, because he's trying to find his dad, yeah. who he understands at least to be.
And he's got this very romanticised view of, firstly, of his dad, secondly, of the life of a musician, and thirdly, of a life as an itinerant, essentially.
And over the course of this miniseries, he's presumably going to have that beaten out of him pretty badly.
He's going to be divested of that, I think, probably, yes. Is this a miniseries? I'm not entirely certain it is.
I guess it was a miniseries. It doesn't say in terms in the indicia. Printed in square brackets, country, close square brackets. Oops.
Maybe it's printed in the country, like out in the boonies.
I would assume this is a mini. It's just, you know... Who does ongoing series anymore, other than people working for major licensed publishers?
At Image, there are plenty of people doing their ongoings. Chew and Morning Glories and Elephant Men and all these kinds of things.
Well, when it says that, this build will happen over the entire series of Severed.
So there must be a mini.
There's a finite ending. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it might be something like Chew, where they've got a 60-issue run planned or whatever. Yeah. Simultaneously with Jack's running away happening, a very shady fella by the name of Mr. Porter, who is referred to in no uncertain terms as the Nightmare by the narrator.
In bold caps, yes, mind you.
Gets a young apprentice given to him by an orphanage, a little boy called Frederick, who claims he's going to teach him how to be an electrician. And then as it goes on, it turns out that poor wee Frederick may not see the second issue of this series because of the very heavy-handed hint-dropping that goes on by the Nightmare about the fact that he's got second rows of razor-sharp teeth behind his own teeth, and the kid thinks he's joking and everything.
Kid thinks it's a metaphor, to be fair.
Yeah, it's a metaphor for other teeth, is what it is.
Yeah, it's not a metaphor, it's an actual thing.
Yes.
I rather liked this. I liked the visual style of it.
The sepia tinted kind of look to the colours.
One thing I thought was interesting about this is that even though all of these scenes, or a lot of these scenes, are supposedly taking place in towns, all mm-hmm. you ever actually see in the external shots are individual buildings sitting in expanses of ground on their own. Mm-hmm. There's a nice set, there's a nice subconscious sense of isolation,
within there, yeah.
And some,
and when the train is going cross country as well, when you exterior shots of the train, it's a train against big expanses of open country.
And there's some odd choices as well in camera angles, which you, every so often it just uses angles which would normally suggest that somebody's watching.
Yeah.
In a way that they don't seem to be in the plot. It's just putting the camera in a very odd place, like that shot there.
And it does help to build up a sense of kind of paranoia, I guess, around what's going on, or certainly of unease.
But at the same time, there's something a bit Norman Rockwell about it.
There is. I mean, for me, the obvious touch point is Ray Bradbury. It's very much in line with the kind of Something Wicked This Way Comes kind of stories, and the sorts of things where Bradbury writes the stories about sort of the beginning of the 20th century, the 1910s and 1920s, where it's idyllic, endless summers and so on, which have got something rotten underneath. And something horrible, which is just beneath the surface, that kids, particularly kids, because it's always kids, don't want to look at too closely because it might be a bit scary and a bit unfortunate for them. And I'm an enormous fan of Ray Bradbury. I actually saw it 2002. I went to San Diego Comic Con, and there was a panel that was Ray Bradbury and Julia Schwartz on the panel, basically interviewing each other. And it was amazing. And I went there and thought, well, I should go and see this because, you know, Bradbury is pretty old. I mean, Schwartz was old as well. I thought, Bradbury's really old. Bradbury could die in the next year quite easily. And then it was Schwartz that died within the next year, which is unfortunate and ironic and sad. But I was very pleased to get to see Bradbury. Anyway, that's a total digression, but I'm a huge Bradbury fan. And this is very much the kind of stories that he likes to tell, particularly in his short stories. There's also a kind of a Stephen Kingish element to it, where you've got a boy who has to go up against an adult threat.
Mm.
So many of King's books have a kid hero who will have to come through adversity to get the better of some kind of monstrous adult in hiding, where an authority figure of some kind is actually disguising some kind of menace underneath the surface.
I mean, that's very much the formula here. I mean, this first issue isn't exactly heavy on plot. It's basically introducing your lead character and then do a subplot which is setting up the villain.
Mm.
It's approaching menace.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very well done. It's a bit heavy-handed at times. I think the whole nightmare thing seems just a bit too obvious to me in a way that doesn't quite fit with the visuals, which otherwise
it's a bit more subtle for the rest of the book.
Yeah, it's just that sort of lacks subtlety in a book which otherwise has quite a bit of subtlety to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked this. I like that just the way it just builds the atmosphere. I think the art is beautiful.
It's gorgeous art. The colours are just magnificent on this book. Really, really beautiful pages. The kind of thing where you almost expect... It's very much actually like sort of Sandman style of art. It's the kind of thing where if this was written by Neil Gaiman, you wouldn't be immensely surprised. Partly because I suppose one of Gaiman's more recent, in the last 15 years, his touchstones have been the weirdness at the heart of America. Which obviously is something that plays into this.
I think it's an interesting thing that they've aligned the villain, the nightmare, mm-hmm. whatever he turns out to be, with General Electric, of all things, which in 1916 represents modernity and the march of progress.
Yeah.
But it's a very odd thing to align a villain with, because I mean, he's in terms of imagery, he's all associated with light and...
He's the guy that's, bringing the light. That can't be as obvious as that.
Oh, God.
He can't, no, surely not. Oh, they're not no. going. They're not going to Lucifer, are they?
They could be, couldn't they? I choose to believe that's not it.
Yeah. But yeah, he's supposedly the guy that's bringing light into places, but what he's actually doing is just leading people into darkness. Which I guess actually really works for this particular character's MO. If you're going to be going around getting little boys and dragging them into a scary house to eat them. I mean, why is dragging them into a scary house to eat them other than because it amuses him to do so. I don't know.
Yeah, fewer passers-by.
Yeah, I mean, there's nobody in this comic, though. I mean, apart from the half-dozen characters that are viewpoint nobody. Characters, they're, in order to find a group of people, Jack has to go away from where he's supposed to be, and then away from where he even ends up, which is in the carriage of the train, because in the carriage of the train there is one person. But it's only when he gets flung out to nearly his death out of the train that he actually finds more than one person at a time. There are no crowds here, there's no bustle, there's no civilization in life.
Right, let's say there's only one group of characters in the
and
entire...
And it's the hobos that are standing between the train carriages. Yeah, there's a lot of... you could probably do a small thesis on this once the series is finished. Certainly a middle-length book review. Moving on to Mystic.
I really like
Cross-Gen
this.
Marvel. Yeah, we should probably say at the beginning of this review, this is you thought that was a positive review. Wait till you hear this one.
Yeah, this is the third Cross-Gen relaunch from Marvel, written by G. Willow Wilson, art by David and Alvaro Lopez. And what's Nathan Fairbairn doing on this? Is he the colourist?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, colourist Nathan Fairbairn. So we're now on to the third Cross-Gen relaunch. And so far, just to recap, we've had Rose, which was basically the same as it was before, only with the sigil element stripped out. We've had Sigil, which bore no resemblance at all to the original Sigil comic, other than keeping the name of the lead character. And strangely, a time travel segment in the later issues, which brings in the entire cast of El Cazador.
Okay.
And now we get Mystic, which
falls kind of between both of those
positions.
Yes.
Now,
did you ever read Mystic?
I did not read the original series, but I did look it up on Wikipedia to see how much there was in common. And this seems to be... You can see how it's loosely templated on the original Mystic.
In that there are two girls, yes. The original Mystic had... One of them gets the power, and she's the party girl. She has no interest in being the good daughter. She's kind of an embarrassment to her entire family. Whereas her sister, who is the quote-unquote good one, gets kind of left out in the cold because she doesn't get the sigil.
Which is, you know, fine as a starting point.
Yeah, and this takes the idea of the two sisters who are opposed in personalities and the idea of the sigil going to the ostensibly wrong one. It's not the sigil, but it's the being chosen for the magical purpose.
Well, but she's not so clearly the wrong one in this one, in this version, though.
Well, there's the one who wants it and who really has the aptitude for learning about the magic side of things. And who's kind of head in the clouds one, who's desperate to be chosen to be one of these 10 apprentices of the high wizard guy. And then there's the other one who does the sums and keeps the money and engineers things, kind of the Violet Baudelaire of the pair of them.
Who is the more cynical, the more streetwise, I guess, of the two. But who also is into magic, just without the sort of sense of hope and dreaminess attached in the way that her sister does.
The pair of them are orphans staying at an orphanage of Mistress Alinora.
Where they are cruelly treated.
They are cruelly treated by the harsh person who runs the orphanage. You can tell why Disney wanted to buy comics like this, if you can repurpose it into this kind of thing, because it's a very kind of Disney setup.
Well, that's the interesting thing about this. As we've said, it's loosely based on the original Mystic. You can see where the echoes of the original setup have survived. Mm-hmm. But virtually every change that's been made to this has had the effect of making it more like a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clearly intentional. Mm-hmm. This is an outright fairy tale comic. It is the Disneyest thing you could possibly imagine, short of actually having Mickey Mouse in it.
Yeah, it's got these kind of steampunky style elements to it, these magic robot dogs and stuff like that. So to an extent, it's actually closer to...
Studio Ghibli. Actually,
yeah, I was going to say, it's closer to some of Ghibli's stuff than to Disney's stuff. But it's got well-drawn characters in it, in both senses of the phrase well-drawn, because Genevieve and Giselle, who are the two girls, you're only getting to know them for one issue, but their personalities come across so strongly and so clearly And the dialogue from, you couldn't swap their dialogue balloons and still have the same characters. You know, Wilson has really given them distinctive and individual voices. In fact, she's given most of the characters in this book distinctive and individual voices. There are a couple of fairly generic orphans early on, but apart from
that, they're background characters, they don't really matter.
Yeah. Apart from that, you know, you've got the high wizard guy and you've got the woman who runs the orphanage, who are broadly drawn. You know, they're not terribly nuanced characters.
They're archetypes.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's, you know, there's a fine line between an archetype and a cliche, but these guys work in this comic because of the type of story that is trying to be told here by Wilson. But at the same time, you've also got Lopez's artwork.
Just beautiful.
Stunning. I mean, Lopez was great when he was doing things like Hawkeye and Mockingbird, but this is incredible. This is like the child of Steve Ditko, China Clugston, and Paul Pope. It's just beautiful artwork, and Fairbairn's colours are stunning.
You're right, David Lopez has done, you know, some perfectly good superhero work before, but this is just in a different league. It's absolutely, absolutely gorgeous. It's some of the best art I've seen in ages.
And really well-drawn sort of facial expressions as well. It's every so often you get an artist who comes along who's really good at facial expressions. Your kind of Kevin Maguire's or your Jamie McKelvey's and people like that. And Lopez looks like he's going down that kind of road as well.
This is a comic which has set out to be unashamedly a Disney fairy tale. And it's succeeded. It's absolutely on every... It is what it has set out to be, yeah, which is a proper Disney fairy
tale. It's not pastiching a Disney fairy tale. It is being a kind of exemplar of that kind of story. Of the best of Disney as well, not of, you know, this is not a Fox and the Hound kind of Disney. This is a Beauty and the Beast kind of Disney.
No, you could easily imagine this as a Disney film. Easily. It's very, very good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually a little bit surprised because I wasn't expecting much from the cross-gen titles, I have to say.
Ruse was good. Sigil was a bit of a disappointment.
I didn't bother with any more of Sigil after the first issue. I ordered the trade of Ruse. But, you know, Ruse was always good, and bringing it back as essentially the same thing, but with the Sigil scraped off,
yeah.
You know, I was expecting it to be as good as it was. But this, I mean, the original Mystic series was really nothing to write home about. This is miles ahead of what the original Mystic series was.
I mean, it's not naturally going to appeal to the typical direct market audience. Frankly, the core audience of something like this ought to be prepubescent girls.
Yeah,
but it's one of these things which is it's a kids' comic, but it's so well done that it works for all ages.
Comic for smart kids. Give this to a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old. I think. I'm going to keep reading this.
Absolutely,
and I'm 31. So
The good Disney films work for all ages.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Finally, now moving on to Cloak and Dagger. Cloak and Dagger, Spider Island, apparently.
Yes, apparently this is a Spider Island tie-in, which, in other words, we want to do a Cloak and Dagger miniseries. Nobody's going to buy that. Let's claim it's a tie-in to Spider Island and, you know, basically just use some stuff that's going on in Spider Island in the background as the token action scene, which, you know, frankly, you could take that out and replace it with a random attack by AIM, and it would be exactly the same comic thus far. Maybe that will change in the later issues, because a couple of the Fear Itself tie-ins, in fairness, they only become obvious why they're Fear Itself tie-ins about two or three issues in.
Yeah, Fear Itself the Deep has done that, where it has taken a fairly generic Doctor Strange plotline and has stapled it onto the side of Fear Itself.
Yeah.
But it's worth it.
So I'm not saying that there's two more issues in which the Spider Island stuff might turn out to genuinely play into the plot. But thus far, this looks very much like it's a Cloak and Dagger story, trying to boost its sales by mentioning Spider Island in a role where, you know, frankly, any passing threat would have done. That's not criticism.
Yeah, yeah. What we get in this book is, I mean, it starts off very, I think it's quite sweet, actually. They give us a full-page recap of everything that's happening in Spider Island at the minute, which just is completely ignored. vast majority of the rest of the comics.
It explains why some Spider Island stuff shows up in passing, but you're right, it's not really what the book's about, which is why the book then launches into three or four pages recapping the origin of Cloak and Dagger.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's the kind of thing we take it for granted. Oh, yeah, you know the story of Cloak and Dagger, the runaways and the drugs and the mutant powers.
You know Cloak and Dagger, remember their origin story? Came out in 1985? Of course you do.
Yeah, tying Cloak and Dagger into Spider Island makes a certain amount of sense because they started off in Spectacular Spider-Man and Spidey supporting characters.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have flitted in and out of Spider-Man's world since then, and things like Maximum Carnage and Dagger joined the New Warriors at the time when Ben Reilly was in the New Warriors, that kind of thing. So they've always had a link with Spidey.
But nonetheless, they're first and foremost freestanding characters.
They have been, certainly for many, many years.
They're interesting in that Cloak and Dagger, as originally conceived, are gimmick characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're Cloak and Dagger. And yet that's really gimmicky.
That's a 1980s BBC One Saturday night comedy duo.
They're like opposites. Because like one of them's poor and black and the other's rich and white and they're opposite. Yeah, everything about them is opposite, but they come together and they're Cloak and Dagger.
You can almost hear the sitcom theme tune.
But it's such a strong visual.
Mm-hmm.
And the later writers have managed to build, you know, some reasonably decent stories around the relationship, around these two characters. Largely, I think, because they've kind of moved away from the original rich kid, poor kid thing. Mm-hmm. And focused more on what the two of them have in common.
Yeah, and the relationship between the relationship them, which has always been key to the two of them. When you ignore the relationship between Cloak and Dagger, you lose what makes Cloak and Dagger a concept that works. Without the relationship between them, they're just a gimmick, and you could honestly come up with 10 of those.
Yeah, and I like the way this issue does focus absolutely on the relationship between the two of them, mm-hmm. and makes that what this story is about.
Mm.
Yeah, there's some Spider Island stuff going on in the background, but this is about the relationship between Cloak and Dagger and where Cloak sees their lives going and where Dagger sees their lives going. And remember, although it's not played up in this issue, which is odd actually, because it's something you would think they would want to mention because it would affect what Dagger's going on about. The idea used to be that they were kind of stuck together as well.
Because Cloak's hunger meant that he basically would go a bit mad if he didn't get fed with Dagger's light.
Yeah, so Cloak needs Dagger to keep him sane.
Mm-hmm.
And so Cloak is literally dependent on Dagger in a way that Dagger is not dependent on Cloak,
mm-hmm.
Which doesn't matter as long as they both want to be together.
But as soon as one of them decides that actually they don't want to be together, then bad stuff starts to happen.
Yeah.
Which is
a fine setup.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. This book makes that the axis around which the whole thing revolves. I mean, yes, there is also a villain plot. Mr. Negative is in this series. He's been used a lot in Spider-Man books recently, but it looks like this is heading towards some kind of confrontation. I think he's probably going to be the villain of this series.
Clearly.
You're not going to have just three issues of the two of them moping about of each other. But the writer, Nick Spencer, who is one of the busiest men in comics, I think, and actually managed to get a threefer this week. He had a book out from Marvel, a book out from DC, and a book out from Image.
Image's Morning Glories. What was the DC book?
Thunder Agents.
Oh, okay.
And then this as well. I can't remember the last person who actually managed to do that, have a book out from Marvel, DC, and Image in the same week.
Warren Ellis possibly at the time, and he had so many backlogged stuff, backlogged comics all coming out at once. Seriously. Yeah, I mean, the Mr. Negative thing, one problem I do have with this book is I really like the stuff between Cloak and Dagger.
Mm-hmm.
I do kind of get the feel that having built that as his central idea, Nick Spencer maybe has found himself thinking, I better work a villain into this.
Well, he does.
And that feels a bit sort of, that's not as strong, at least.
Yeah, well, he does spend 5 pages on Mr. Negative at the back of this issue, which, you know, if you're going to be setting up your villain, it's clearly not just something that's tacked on to the end.
What way of setting up the villain as well, because he actually makes Mr. Negative look a lot weaker here than he normally does in Spider-Man. And that's a strange way of setting up the villain.
And slightly sympathetic.
Yes, well,
he's just not wanting to die.
Yes, true.
It's a thing. And, you know, you can empathise with not wanting to die. It's a fairly sort of standard thing, I would have thought, for most people.
Why Mr. Negative? He is a crime lord. He's got the black and white thing.
He's also got drug links.
True.
From the first issues that he was used in Amazing Spider-Man.
That's true, actually.
In the Brand New Day era.
If you look at, given that Cloak and Dagger are supposed to be obsessed with going after drug dealers,
mm-hmm.
of the current crop of Marvel villains, actually Mr. Negative, just by job description, qualifies as a suitable
mm-hmm.
Cloak and Dagger villain. Although yeah. Cloak himself seems to be less interested in that this issue.
Yeah, Cloak is just a bit... I don't want to say he's getting obsessed, but he really does seem to be... Everything about him is... He's got nice guy syndrome. He's like, why would Dagger want to be with someone else? I treat her so well. And Dagger's just like, I wish he would stop smothering me. He wouldn't understand. I can't tell him this stuff. And Cloak's like, she could tell me anything and I would understand.
Cloak's not a very sympathetic character here. I mean, Dagger is clearly the focal point of the issue. Dagger is our point of view character.
They're both being... Neither one of them is being completely sympathetic. Cloak is definitely smothering her and is definitely patronising her as well.
Mm.
And Dagger is being kind of cruel to him. She doesn't want to tell... I mean, he is her best friend of many, many, many years. And she doesn't want to tell him that she's going off and doing classes at a learning annex. You know, it's just a bit ridiculous, particularly given that he has just told her that he went and learned how to do, you know, seminars and how to set up a small business and stuff like that. That must have been interesting, seeing him sitting in there with a great big billowing cloak. Any questions? Yes, you, the shadowy hell nemesis man at the back there. Yes. Yes, 401ks. Yeah, sure, we can talk about that. On the art side of things, Emma Rios is drawing this. And Emma Rios, last series that I read her do was the Doctor Strange mini that Mark Waid wrote.
Oh, right. Did you not buy Osborne?
I bought the first issue of Osborne, and I liked it. But I was waiting for the trade paperback.
That's a good series.
Yeah, I'd say I only read the first issue of it, but it was good. But I was waiting on the trade.
I mean, I know a lot of people will have thought... a Norman Osborn story. Goodness, it's been literally seconds since we had one of them. But
that did put me off to begin with. But the combination of, you know, good writer, good artist, and then on the backup in that first issue, good writer, good artist as well.
It's just the backups don't continue through the series. But,
well, in the first issue, it was good.
Yeah, it's a strong story, and it's far enough away from anything that was being done in Dark Reign that if you bored to tears with Norman Osborn and Dark Reign stories, well, you know, this is something different, and it's a different direction for the character.
She's one of Marvel's, I think, best up-and-coming artists, and the work that she's doing on this, I think, is the best work that she's done for Marvel.
I like what she's doing with the cloak, actually, the way you're getting these sort of swirly effects around the side of the page.
The two
it's a really
pages,
lovely laid out hourglass shape on that double page
where
spread.
She's going, where Dagger's going to the her night classes at the same time that Cloak is still fighting against all these people dressed up as Spider-Man.
Cloak is such a gift to artists who are able to make use of that weird design. It's one of these characters who gives you an excuse to cut loose. Vic Leonardo used to do a wonderful Cloak.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to see Mark Bagley draw Cloak, but I'd love to see Bill Sienkiewicz draw him.
Yes, he's one of these... He's a character who doesn't quite fit in the Marvel House style,
mm-hmm.
but the more impressionist you are, the more you can do with him.
Mm.
He should look a bit sort of out of place and sort of just sort of shapeless.
Yeah, and that certainly is what Rios manages to get across. Her art is great. I mean, it's truly great. She's got a very different style to either of the other books that we've reviewed on this episode. But, you know, it really, really suits the characters. Even small things like whenever Dagger's just moving around normally, there's this kind of paint flecks of white around her, symbolising just glittering light that she trails around behind her wherever she goes.
Oh yeah,
which is nice. It's cracking. I think it's absolutely great. The characters as a pair are, as we say, a gimmick with a lot of the time not much behind that. There have been as many rubbish, unsuccessful Cloak and Dagger stories as there have been that have been any good at all. The last person to really have a handle on them, I think, was Terry Austin.
I think who was it who wrote that book after Austin left? I think Steve Gerber had a brief run on it, which I think was quite good. But yeah, the Terry Austin Cloak and Dagger series in the late 80s is really surprisingly good. Mm. Commercially suicidal.
Yeah, I mean,
they killed Cloak in issue two and then blinded Dagger. And then the next six issues, literally the next six issues, and this was a bi-monthly comic, is Cloak is missing and Dagger is learning to walk with a stick.
And it's good.
It is.
It's a good and interesting and entertaining comic.
And there's a villain who's stolen the cloak and is potentially going to be the new cloak. And there's a maniac dressed as a wombat. It's a fantastic series. It's a shame Terry Austin doesn't write more, actually.
Yeah, I don't know what he's been doing for the last few years. I have absolutely no clue. But, I mean, the last Cloak and Dagger thing that came out was that Stuart Moore written one-shot. Do you remember that? When it was all about to write them out of the X-Men.
Yeah, which I assume was... it had a certain ring of, Dear X, we need a Cloak and Dagger script by Monday. Please get them out of the X-Men.
Yeah, it was just... It was very...
We need them away before Schism.
To be honest, very poor. And I didn't give either of them a personality.
I will be charitable and say it was probably a story that had a defined remit of what it needed to do. And at least it got from A to B. It wasn't good, though.
Yeah, this is miles ahead of that.
Yeah.
This is a really good story. It's the kind of thing where you've got D-list Marvel characters who have never been able to sustain a series longer than about, I think about 18 issues is about the longest that they've ever run consecutively.
I think the maybe 25, but not much more.
Yeah, not a whole heck of a lot. But this makes it work and makes you think, I actually would read an ongoing series of this. You know, Nick Spencer's a good writer. Emerios is a good artist. They've got a good take on the characters. They've pitched them against a villain who's at about the right level for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's not to like about this, really? And the Spider Island tie-in is tenuous and minimal at best, and I'm very grateful for that. It might crop up more in the next few issues. I hope it doesn't, because, frankly, Cloak and Dagger was entertaining enough by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's the comics for the week, and we move on now to the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, and we're delving back into that little present, which was almost made just for us, which is the Captain America handbook that came out last month, and has got an absolutely astonishing number of lame characters in it. Including this guy, a bloke called Lou Dexter, otherwise known as the Dead Ringer.
I love that. This is clearly one where somebody came up with the name and worked back.
Because his thing is, he's got necromimicry.
Dead Ringer's
very, very niche power.
Dead Ringer's power is that when he touches a corpse, he can impersonate the dead person for a bit.
It's a cross between Pushing Daisies and Quantum Leap.
It's a very odd power because he's able to mimic. He doesn't just mimic their own body and their superpowers. He mimics their battle armor,
yeah, their equipment and things like that. If if Psycho Man was dead and he touched Psycho Man, he would get Psycho Man's weird box thing that says fear, hate, and like emo or whatever it says on it nowadays.
It's one of the things where, why don't you just call this a magical power? Because making him a mutant's odd.
Yeah, this is the kind of mutants that John Byrne used to really rail against and used to really hate. Because they don't make any sense. Like, why would you mutate to give yourself that ability?
I have to admit, if it were me creating this character, I wouldn't have gone with mutant. I'd have gone with found a mystic thingy.
Yeah, well, his thing is that he can walk around touching corpses and take on their appearance and their equipment and so on.
Mark Grunwald character.
Yes, you can tell. To that end, he carries around a cigar box full of severed fingers, which I don't know how he knows which finger is which. Like, does he keep them all labelled?
I guess he keeps them labelled.
Put different rings on them all, something like that. It put them in compartments, perhaps. Like, he's got one of those great big plastic cases with squashy material inside that people transport Games Workshop miniatures around in.
I mean, he's clearly going to need some sort of labelling system, because since this is the Marvel Universe, all of the characters are going to be white men.
Yes, absolutely. What we should do is we should reinvent him so that all the fingers he carries around with him are of half-black, half-Hispanic characters.
That would very much limit his options.
Yeah, pretty much he can be Ultimate Spider-Man and he can't be anybody else.
Ultimate Spider-Man's not dead yet.
No, but give it time.
Yes, true.
Give it time.
I mean, one of the interesting things about this character is he is a walking continuity error, because he's impersonated several characters who subsequently turned out not to be dead after all, yeah. This being comics.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure he's actually accidentally impersonated a bunch of Skrulls. I'm sure that would be the explanation for it.
The handbook ventures the perhaps slightly defensible explanation that as once he's cut somebody's finger off, mm-hmm. It's dead tissue.
Okay, that works. If I were him, I might just carry around a bunch of locks of hair or, you know, fingernails or something like that, because that's a little bit... I mean, it's still gross, but it's less gross than fingers.
Maybe he just likes the fingers.
He's just totally into fingers.
Yeah, he just likes screaming to people, "Have you seen my box of fingers?"
And people are
I
just...
I can use them to turn into people.
And people are just like, that is the worst chat-up line I've ever heard. It's like, no. It's not a chat-up line. It's a box of fingers.
This guy was a partner of the second Super Patriot. Right. Not the original Super Patriot who went on to become the US agent, mm-hmm. but a later Super Patriot who was, I think, another right-wing nut who was trying to discredit Captain America. Mm-hmm. So the storyline is basically that Dead Ringer was trying to help him out by staging fights between Super Patriot and dead villains, and he would impersonate dead villains, show up, fight Super Patriot, mm-hmm. and lose so that Super Patriot looked good.
Yeah.
That was basically the setup. How did he meet this guy, and how did he break the topic of, by the way...
Have I shown you my dead finger collection?
Well, I think, to be fair, it does mention somewhere along the line that when Super Patriot discovers his dead finger collection, he sort of goes, "Ugh, get away from me."
I can just imagine it on Craigslist. Man with dead finger collection seeks practical application.
Yes. Wanted employment. I'm good at impersonating dead characters.
Do not judge me.
Those killed by Scourge, a speciality.
What they could do with this guy is, I mean, he's... I would be surprised if he were in one of those caterpillar cells that Nick Fury had stashed away all over the world in Secret Warriors. You know, if you were going to put him to work doing anything... Spying would be a really, really good way to use his skills. You can send somebody in who has, you know, their disguise is not going to be blown because they are an exact physical duplicate and they have all that person's stuff as well.
There's actually if you took away the mutant thing, which is just somehow a little too contrived, mm-hmm. made it a magical power, there's something to this that could actually work in a Vertigo-ish way.
If he turns into, say, Obadiah Stane, right, dies, okay,
yes.
As he did. Dead Ringer goes up, touches the body, looks like Obadiah Stane's got all Obadiah Stane's stuff. Could he take off his Rolex, sell the Rolex, touch Stane again, turn back into Stane, remove the Rolex, sell the Rolex. Could you basically become a self-perpetuating eBay machine?
Ooh. Now, presumably the equipment disappears when he stops mimicking things.
Depends how far away you've managed to get by the time you change back, I suppose, once you've pawned it. And it disappears from the shop, but you're by that point three cities away.
Could we do a mini-series about him trying to dig up Elvis?
Well, this is the other thing I was thinking. You know, he could be the most perfect spy ever, or he could be the most in-demand Vegas tribute act that there has ever been. You know,
never mind
quick change artists. You know, he's got dead Liza Minnelli's finger and he touches that and he's Liza Minnelli. He's got dead Celine Dion's head and he touches that and he's dead Celine Dion. He's Elvis Presley and Judy Garland and...
I don't think Celine Dion's dead, Al.
No, but she could... Well, she could be. This is Marvel Universe Celine Dion. This is 616 Celine Dion.
So you're imagining this guy's a Vegas tribute act who sort of bought all of this stuff completely legitimately, like on the black market, or some sort of auction of memorabilia of dead parts of celebrities. I've got another one. It's the head of Celine Dion. where'd you get that? Yeah, it's tragic what happened to her. She was driving down the road and she thought she saw Elvis standing there and she crashed into a tree.
Oh, brilliant.
And then Elvis ran up with a saw. Everyone was shocked.
It was the weirdest dream I've ever had. Yeah, so screw being a super spy. This guy's going to Vegas. Okay, so that's the Dead Ringer. That's the official handbook of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. And that's the end of the podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
If you check the blog, don't forget that there is the video episode of the Thumbcast. That's still up there. If you're listening to this, you probably heard it by now. I don't know. Maybe some of you don't visit the blog. Maybe you just go to the download
from iTunes.
Yeah. So if that's the case, then go to our blog at howtoastonish.com and you'll see about a week back our 9-minute or so video episode.
Yeah, you too can marvel at how much less hair I have than you imagined me having. you can email us as well. We're howtoastonish@gmail.com.
And on Twitter, I am If Destroyed, and Al is House to Astonish.
And we've got a Facebook fan page as well, which if you just go to Facebook and search for House to Astonish, we're right there. As always, any iTunes reviews as well. If you wanted to leave us a little review, that would be very much appreciated, as long as it's nice. Don't leave us a nasty review. That would be great. And we'll see you in about 2 weeks' time.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye.